Our guest on this episode of the podcast is Nikki Munitz, a global expert in self-esteem development and addiction. She is also the author of the book Fraud, a powerful memoir about her journey with drug addiction, with fraud and prison. My name is Nongcebo Vukile Mackenzie. Ngiyakwamukela. Welcome to the podcast. Our guest on this episode of the podcast is Nikki Munitz. She is the author of Fraud, How Prison Set Me Free, a memoir. Nikki, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm intrigued by the title. How does prison set one free?
That's a very interesting question. So fraud for me has so many different meanings. Mm-hmm. Aside from the fact that I obviously committed a crime of fraud, I also spent most of my adult life, mm-hmm. And probably child life as well, mm-hmm. living as a fraud within my own skin, mm-hmm. And not feeling authentically myself. Mm-hmm. And it took going to prison and doing a course around self-esteem, mm-hmm. that really helped me find my direction in life and mm-hmm. develop a relationship with me.
You talk about that when you talk about how you moved from your school at age 10 and going to a different school and really feeling like you're not fitting in and looking at it and thinking, if these wealthy, privileged people that I go to school with knew actually what my life is like back home, what would that mean about me being in this space? And I guess when you say that fraud for you has a different meanings, going right back to your childhood, that's one of the things that you're talking about. But I was quite interested, or rather intrigued or curious. Chapter 3, The Momster. You know, very few people talk about their experiences of the human being that their mother was. We tend to hear just the positive stories about our mothers, and the reality is that in most circumstances, mothers are the ones that are, you know, that find themselves, or women or wives are the ones that find themselves in the negative situations and the negative experiences. So you find a lot of people grow up to empathize with their mothers for what they've been through. But you entitled the chapter The Momster. And I laugh because my daughter's school did a poem about the momster. And it was about how she starts off as a nice mom in the morning, making coffee and making breakfast. And because everybody's running late, she turns into the momster. But that is not your experience. It's not about a mother who is stressed because people are misbehaving. It's an experience of a mother who's throwing plates, who's verbally abusive, who's, you know, not really that nice. What does that do to a person?
Sure. You know, I'm always so torn because there are a lot of good things I could say about my mother. Mm-hmm. And, you know, she did really have a difficult time. She grew up with a mother who was, you know, came here from Poland and had lost her whole family in the Holocaust. And, you know, she obviously was going to be traumatized and have difficulties in life. But I would anticipate someone like that feeling absolute love and devotion to her family in response to that type of life. But instead, my mother felt, I think, bitterness and resentment that, you know, she didn't have the type of life that she had hoped for, mm-hmm. I think, or feel like she deserved. And we bore the brunt of that. And I think also me being a girl and, you know, I experienced her differently to how my brothers did. There was a jealousy or a comparison and often felt like she was trying to live through me on the one hand and on the other hand really holding me back. And just programming my belief system of myself through things that she said to me and, you know, the way that she treated me, that I spent my whole life trying to get love, mm-hmm. From all the wrong places because my mother had taught me how unlovable I actually was, or at least made me believe that. And, yeah, it was just, it's been a challenge reprogramming that wound and healing from that wound. Because I believe even the fraud, me stealing that money was to get love from this family that I had married into, you know, that love and acceptance that I craved so badly. So it's quite a tough one to really kind of comprehend or even to explain to people.
Yeah, it's painful just hearing about it because I suppose, you know, in as much as our parents and in as much as we as parents do our best or think we're doing our best, at some point we are human beings, we have failings. But it also just reminds me of the same interview that I was telling you about where the author was saying that she is aware that some parents, you know, fail doing their best, but some parents just aren't even trying. This is just who they are. And you can, you know, beg them for love. You can tell them how their treatment of you is affecting you. You can do all that you want to do, and they just don't see the error of our ways. And again, it's always quite interesting when you hear that being said about a mother, because, you know, just look at Mother's Day and how, you know, and I suppose how, you know, as mothers, we also, you know, hope that our kids will speak positively of us. But yeah, a lot of people are walking around with a lot of pain because of their experience at the hands of their parents and at the hands of their mothers. So it was quite interesting, Momster, reading about that. But sure, your story is, I don't know, Nikki. <It's>
Me neither sometimes.
Because I always ask myself, how do you come out of all of that? And how do you face yourself after all of that and face yourself against what some people will say, well, she chose that. And some people will say, oh, I went through much worse and I turned out fine. I didn't steal money. I didn't do drugs. I didn't marry the wrong guy. She got a chance to go to rehab. She had a mother who came and, you know, fetched her out of, you know, the flats that she was staying in with drug dealers. And, you know, I went through worse and I've made it. And how do you come out of that life experience? One, owning your story. And secondly, able to say, you know what? I may have made some bad choices, but that doesn't make me a bad person.
Sure. You basically just summarized the whole book and the story, so thank you for that, because that's exactly the point that I wanted to get across. You know, we are built to survive, and anyone can survive anything if we really have to. But like for me, the story is not about surviving, but it's about learning to live. And I didn't know how to live. I knew how to survive. In fact, you could stick me anywhere right now and I think I could survive. But, you know, being able to take my experiences and use them as catalysts to learn more about myself and about life, and to be able to make whatever changes that I need to in my own abilities and my own knowledge of myself and the way that I'm able to interact in life, so that, you know, I could live as the best version of me, and having the most meaningful and significant impact on the world around me and the people around me. So, you know, I'm sure there's people that have had way worse stories than me. And it's not necessarily about the details of the story. And that was even the reason for the book. I want people to be able to read this book and not have to relate to the detail, but rather the experiences internally, you know, our own internal prisons, our own internal experiences, and to know that, you know, I can come out of that on the other side as a more powerful human being, that can live with an internal peace, because that's what I want people to get. That's what I craved. I craved peace, and I went about it in all the wrong ways of getting it. And so, yes, I tried it all, sex, drugs, and rock and roll. and, of course, got completely the opposite of what I was craving so badly. And, you know, this is a story of finding the calm after whatever storm that's manifested and unfolded.
So, You know, I'm scared of asking some of the questions because, you know, it will sort of give the entire book away. Because I wanted to sort of, you talk about it, I think it's on page 33, 34, about how you, you started. But I'm curious about Patrick. How did you meet Patrick and his sandwiches?
It's so interesting because the way that I met Patrick, I was actually, I was in a treatment center in Cape Town. And the treatment center, as a lot of rehabs actually are, in drug areas. And there was a crack house literally across the road from the rehab that I was in. And, you know, I would often stand on the balcony and watch other people buy drugs and, you know, watch how they were, you know, living this life that I used to live and was still craving so badly. And one day I, you know, I just decided to walk across the road and I went and I knocked on the door and I met him. And this became, you know, a friendship to me, however a pseudo friendship that other people might consider. For me, he was quite a lifeline. And, you know, again, just like addicts aren't bad people, in my opinion, a lot of drug dealers aren't either. You know, these are often people that have been misplaced or misguided and trying to survive or feed their families in whichever way. Sure, it has a negative impact on a lot of people's lives. But, you know, me personally, especially after the experience that I've been through, I don't feel like I'm one to judge anyone else's choices or behavior. And I suppose, you know, he's one of those people. And it was a really, it was an important relationship in my life at the time.
And what happens to that kind of relationship when you leave that life behind?
Oh God, it just becomes a memory, I suppose. You know, unfortunately, you know, we talk about when you move into a new lifestyle of recovery, you have to let go of people, places and things. And he was one of those people. And I think it's always about having, you know, people play a role in your life. They have it's a season that they spend with you. And for me, he was part of that season.
Do you believe you would have made it without Patrick?
I'd like to believe that. You know, I have a story to tell and I have a purpose on this earth. And, you know, I have many light workers that revealed themselves in my life in the most weird ways. And throughout the book, I kind of try and show those light workers even in my darkest times.
So it's interesting, again, how, as you said earlier, that there are so many wonderful things that you can say about your mother. Because, I mean, all of us, we have, if you were to line up 10 people in a room, maybe 7 would say, oh my goodness me, not her. And then 3 would say, whoo, what a lovely person. Or the other way around, 3 would be like, oh my goodness, not her. And 7 would be like, what a lovely person. But how she comes to rescue you, can I say that, in Cape Town? But then I ask myself, because you say she was forced into some kind of action. I found that choice of words interesting because you talk about in the book how when you were working, out working at night and you longed for her to ask, where are you getting this money from? Because, I mean, it was clear but not spoken. You longed for that. It creates the impression that she was aware but didn't really want to be aware of a lot, could have taken action, did take action, sometimes didn't. And I found the choice of words of forced into some kind of action. My mother books a flight and lands in the mother city. And I'm not going to read more because I'll give the entire book away again.
Yeah, I think, you know, like many people, we're kind of driven by what other people will think. And I think that if she got a call from someone as she did, she had the choice in that moment to say, well, you know, I'm not going to action the information that's just been shared with me, but then what would people say about me in this situation? And so I believe in that regard, she was kind of forced into actioning something. Mm-hmm. In the same breath, she probably also could have said, you know, like, I don't really care what people think, you know, mm-hmm. she got herself into this mess, she needs to get herself out of it. Mm-hmm. But I do think that there was often a driving force in my mother's life where if she had an opportunity to step into a hero role, she would do that. So she would step in as the rescuer, even though she also played quite the role as the villain. Mm-hmm. you know, and I guess we all get to switch roles between victim, villain, and hero. But, you know, if she had the opportunity to either be the victim or the hero, she would quite willingly and happily step into that space.
So let's fast forward to prison. And in fast forwarding to prison, let's step back again into how it all unfolded. You talk about it in chapter two, because you start in the present and you go back to your upbringing, and then you come back again in the book. And you talk about the front page of the Pretoria News, and you talk about this is now the, you know, the picture perfect Nikki. This is now the working Nikki, the stable Nikki, but again with the husband that, you know, carried on in oblivion when all this broke out. How do you get here? How do you get to no man's land?
Sure. So I think that, you know, again, that feeling of being a fraud, I felt so like at a sense of dis-ease internally. And initially I tried very hard to create that peace and that comfort through, in inverted commas, the right channels. So excelling at school, doing really like well in my studies, in my sport, with friendships. And that's why at face value, everything looked absolutely beautiful and on the surface level, and no one would have guessed what was really going on internally. And when that excelling and that doing really well didn't give me the feeling that I was after, I then transitioned all the way to the other side and started experimenting, you know, with drinking and with boys and, you know, hoping that that would then give me the peace that I was after. And the truth is, it did initially. Yeah. You know, this is the part that they don't tell you. It took the edge off, you know. Really? It made me feel like I belonged, like there was a place for me in the world.
Belonged to what? Then,
just that there were other, you know, there's actually a TED talk called Misfits. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And, you know, for me, that's what it was. It was like a band of misfits. And I think that's what a lot of teenagers go through.
Uh-huh.
You know, and the peer pressure that we talk about is how finally this band of misfits all find their space. Mm-hmm. And it works for a while until it doesn't. And then it starts having the opposite effect. And that emptiness, that missing piece, not only exists anymore, it now starts to get even bigger. And that's why we're looking for more thrills, more hits, bigger, badder, whatever it is, in order to try and fill that now void that's grown. And it's just not working anymore.
Okay, so that's why I was asking, belong to what? Because I wasn't sure if you feel a sense of belonging as in you feel more at peace with yourself, or more at peace that who you are or how you are extending yourself externally, there are actually people like me, so I'm not abnormal. And so that's why I was asking, when you say, okay, so you find other like-minded beings, so everybody has their tribe essentially, so it makes you feel like, oh, I finally have a home. What I call home isn't really home, and here is a home of sorts. When I say home, I don't mean a place to go to, but people that I feel that I can be a version of me with.
Absolutely. And we all do need a tribe. Mm-hmm. And we spend our lives finding that place to belong. Mm-hmm. And what we don't realize is that place to belong has to first and foremost be with ourselves. Mm. And, you know, that's why we get so lost along the way, because we forget that relationship as the most important relationship in our life first, before any other relationship that we will ever have.
And I always wonder what it is about our parental relationships that makes us move away from ourselves, because, you know, this is what a lot of people who have grown up in a home that has some level of instability. And listen, no home is perfect, but there are degrees to it. And they will always say, you know, I just wanted to feel like I belong, or I feel like I make sense, or to feel like I'm someone. And I wonder what it is about those relationships that makes you feel sort of separate from yourself. And I wonder, like, in the work that you're doing now, how prevalent is that in the people that you're working with now? Because you work a lot in that space, you know, with empowering people to have self-confidence and, you know, to be self-assured, which goes a long way in making the right decisions in life.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, this is exactly the work that I do. Essentially, we are raised, I want to call it back to front, because the way that we're raised is to try and fit in, to make sure that, you know, we conform, to have the right job, the right house, the right car, the right education, and with anticipation that all of those things are going to miraculously make us feel mm-hmm. whole and connected internally. And they don't do that. You know, it's like, you know, tying a sandwich to the outside of your body and expecting that to you know, satisfy your hunger. It's just not going to work that way. And so instead of our loved ones showing us that it's an inside job, it's about getting to know us first and foremost, so that we know what is the right job path for me, what is the right relationship for me. I don't know myself at all, and so I'm getting all of these external things to tick boxes without truly having an internal knowledge of myself as a starting point. And that's why a lot of the time I land up in business partnerships or relationships with people that I don't actually have a shared value system with mm-hmm. or a shared connection with, because I don't have enough knowledge of me going into any certain like situation, you know, as a primary point. And then I'll end up fighting either with myself or with the other party involved. So it's not our parents' fault, because they were raised in that way, you know, to make sure that you have all the pieces in place. At no point is anyone saying the starting point, the most important piece, is the piece with yourself. And so the work that I do is to focus first and foremost with the relationship with self. Mm-hmm. And from that point, we can then start to work outwardly. So I can figure out, you know, what are the things that I like? What are my value system? Mm-hmm. What are my points of interest, my vision, my purpose? What's a life of balance look like for me? Mm-hmm. What are the ways that I'm able to deal with my feelings effectively? How do I address issues around body image? Mm-hmm. How do I address areas of weakness in my life? And from that point, I'm then in a much better position to be able to function within the society and the world around me.
Mm-hmm. So you were still sharing how you landed up. I'm not sure how to term it. You know, I'm always worried about, you know, capturing
don't,
things.
Don't.
So how you landed up in the situation that got you in prison, because you'd done so much work. You'd gone back, gotten your undergraduate degree. Mm-hmm. You'd survived so much. I mean, with Patrick, with Verna, you'd survived all those situations. Or maybe what I should be asking is, how do you backslide into a pattern that is different when you've got so much a pattern that is this pattern, but, you know, manifests itself in different ways? Because, I mean, you weren't back on the drugs now, but you were sort of like enmeshed in it and, you know, in this situation. When you've done so much work and you've figured it out to some extent and you've built yourself up time and time again, what is it that leads you back there?
So, the patterns, you know, are quite subconscious mm-hmm. and part of our programming. But I also believe that this was my destiny. This was my path that I was meant to follow, mm-hmm. which is why I believe that prison set me free. I needed to walk this road so that I could learn enough about me and to be able to help people learn about themselves and set themselves free from their own self-imposed prisons. And the journey was about becoming. You know, I even though I was 8 years clean when I went into prison. Mm-hmm. And I really had significantly turned my life around. And that's why I feel like it's destiny, because I tried for 8 years to avoid having to walk that particular part of my journey. Mm-hmm. And whatever entity in the universe, higher power, God, whatever it is that anyone believes, this was the road that I needed to walk on. And, you know, I there was just no getting away from it, even though I tried and essentially tortured myself in the process, because I tried to avoid it for so many years. Essentially, you know, I could have served my prison time and got it over and done with, but instead I lived with a sword of Damocles over my head while trying to sidestep, you know, the purpose of my life. Yeah, it just pulled me in, and it was where I needed to go and where I needed to be. Otherwise, I think I would have been destined to get there in some other way. You know, I would have made some further mistakes, and mm-hmm. instead I just allowed the path to eventually unfold as it needed to.
So you were released on 29 April 2016. This is from your second stint in prison.
Yes.
And mm-hmm. how have things been since then?
Initially, when I came out of prison, life was horrible, which sounds really weird, but I was really lost. Mm-hmm. I think the trauma of the whole experience had finally caught up to me, and, you know, I just really wasn't sure what to do with myself at that point, which is why I really started learning more about self-esteem and the current work that I do. But it was a really difficult and painful process, probably more difficult and painful than any of the addiction, any of the prison stuff that I had been through.
Really?
Was the process. Yeah, it was really tough. You know, I don't think I've ever felt more lost and alone than I did at that point, which I suppose also because my expectation was that I was supposed to feel peaceful mm-hmm. at that point, which I still didn't. And now this part of my journey, having learned more about myself and about self-esteem and really finding my niche in this world and what I believe my purpose is in this world, to be able to teach others about how to empower themselves and to change their lives. This has been nothing short of miraculous. And I mean, I even get emotional just thinking about it, because it's been such a blessing. And I know a lot of people say that about their lives, mm-hmm. but if I could explain to you what I get to do on a daily basis mm-hmm. and watch people who have lived in pain and torment, like watch their light come on, and I get to be a part of that every single day, seeing people come alive. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, they don't make fantasies up like this. It's so beautiful.
So you are somebody else's Patrick, you're somebody else's Werner, you're somebody else's Clive, you're somebody else's Captain Koniwe, you're all those people.
Exactly. That's the most beautiful way I've ever heard it described. Thank you. Yes, I get to be that to many, many people every single day of my life. Mm-hmm. I mean, how cool is that story?
And how are your children?
Wow. You know, my son is 16 and my daughter is 18. My daughter is probably my biggest teacher. She is so wise beyond her years. Mm-hmm. And, you know, mothers and daughters, we went through our rough patch. I can't even call her my best friend because we're not friends. I'm her mom and mm-hmm. she's my daughter. But our relationship is one that is built on trust and openness. You know, you mentioned earlier about momster. Mm-hmm. As a mother, I have and continue to make regular mistakes. Mm-hmm. That's not the issue. The issue is that my children can come to me and say, Mom, I really didn't like it when you did A, B, and C. It made me feel this way. Mm-hmm. And I can actually say, wow, you know, I didn't think about that. Thank you for giving me that feedback. I'm really sorry I made you feel that way. And for me, that's where the growth is. That's where the beauty is. It's not about not making mistakes. It's not about being the perfect mom, but it's about being the mom who's willing to grow and to change and to look at her stuff, you know. And my son is often described as a miniature version of me. So often I think the two of us live in our own little bubble, and he helps me grow because I see my own maturity develop through his, you know, the contrast with his immaturity and his growth. And they are just really like well-established, really kind, gentle, loving and wise human beings that I'm grateful for every single day.
And how are your brothers?
I think they're good. We don't really have too much of a relationship. I think a lot of damage was done to all of us in our childhood, and a damage that I don't think is rectifiable. Partly because I think I've grown a lot, and also partly because I don't think they have a desire to grow, which is okay. You know, we're all on our own path, and they're all really close, and I remain the outsider. And I used to fight for my space in their life, which I now choose to no longer do.
And if I can ask, or if I may ask, and if you're comfortable with answering this question, and how was your brother's journey? Because one of the things you talk about in the book is that you loved him, you emulated him in a lot of ways, and he was also experimenting with drugs. And how are things for him now?
My brother was very lucky to find a wife who is quite a grounding force for him, and I think for the most part kept him manageable to an extent. I think the damage from his addiction is quite prevalent in that there's an immaturity to him, even though he's the eldest out of all four of us. There's an immaturity still in his behavior, but he functions, and he's also a husband and a dad, but also quite childlike. You know, he will go partying with his kids and things like that, and maybe that's normal. Maybe I'm not, you know, the best example to go by, but you know, for me, it's not a lifestyle I choose to partake in anymore. But he definitely, out of all of us, probably he has a kindness to him that probably was a sensitivity that was his weakness. But he's functional. I wouldn't call him clean and sober, but he's functional.
And may I ask about your mom?
Sure. So my mother is around. For a long time, I tried to have a relationship with her. And first of all, I become someone I don't particularly like when I interact with her. There's a lot of triggers and old wounds that surface every time we're together. But they also started to surface in my children. And my children one day made a decision to no longer have contact with her. And I don't force the issue. And because I saw the same wounds being created in them through her, I decided to take a step back and you know, be one step removed from it. It's just not worth it. And so many people think because it's a blood relative, you have to. And for me, I don't live like that anymore. It doesn't matter if you're a blood relative. If you're not beneficial to me in my life, if you're not having a positive impact, then it doesn't mean I have to have you around.
You know, I find it quite interesting, and this is something that you talk about in the book, that although your relationship with him at that stage had been quite short before you had to deal with other things, Clive decided to move in with your mother because of his concerns, obviously, about the children. And it's always interesting because regardless of what a person has been like as a mother, there's always this belief, and I think based on patterns, that people become amazing grandparents. And people will be like, well, you know, she was so strict with me, and she was so this with me, or she was so that with me, or he was so that with me, if they're talking about their father, that I'm not seeing that in my children. They're lovely with my children. They're sweet with my children. They're all the things that I wish they had been with me. And grandparents will tell you, well, you know, I don't have to teach your children anything. You've taught them that they can have takeaways for breakfast. Fine by me. I've done my teaching, you know, and that's why, you know, we see a different side to them. But I think maybe the reason I was curious, or the reason I asked the question about how is she now, and you extended that to the children, is I was curious as to whether her journey led to her discovering a different way of being, that maybe she wasn't able to be with you, and that she was able to then, and I think a lot of grandparents do this in compensation as well, I think, that they then shower that onto their grandchildren. And, you know, that's, I was just curious about that.
That's a great question. I think, you know, a lot of grandparents realize maybe their mistakes they made as parents, and maybe they were too harsh or too strict or, you know, unkind, but they would have to have realized that they made some errors along the way. And I don't believe my mom has. Mm-hmm. I truly believe she thinks she was an absolute martyr, hero. Like, you know, she did everything wonderfully. And so if you don't feel like you've made any mistakes, there's nothing you're going to change. Mm-hmm. And so she would often repeat the same things with my children. Mm-hmm. And I suppose it was also messy because we lived with her, you know, for a while. So that role, she almost played the role of husband for at some stage. So it's confusing, it was messy, and so she didn't really necessarily get the clear role as grandparent. Mm-hmm. But in the same breath, even with my brother's children, she also she didn't have a great role as a grandmother. So it wasn't just with my kids. And
so it's not, you know, personal, it's just not about Nikki.
I don't think so. I think it's her stuff, and I think her lack of insight into her own shortcomings and mistakes is where the problem is.
Mm. But I'm wondering if you ever find yourself caught, because in as much as, you know, living with her led to you experiencing that and seeing her be that way with your children, it was also a place of refuge for you at difficult times, you know, even though she was all these other things. And this is why you very clearly said at the beginning, you know, and we keep on gravitating towards the conversation about your mother. You said this in the beginning, that she's not a bad person. There are many wonderful things you can say about her, but unfortunately, it's the bad parts about people that hurt us. Like, a person can be wonderful with 90 things, and then it's just the 10 little things that they do that will just completely break us. And I suppose, you know, people will then say, well, can't you appreciate the good stuff? Because the good stuff is great, as you said, you know, be beneficial, and beneficial in the sense that emotionally healthy for me, not beneficial in that I'm getting something from you, but be emotionally healthy for me in all the ways that I need and that you can be. And that can compensate for any other thing, really. But if that's not what I'm getting in the relationship.
Mm.
Yeah.
So, yeah, unfortunately, you know, they're just, the bad outweighed the good.
Yeah.
You know, for lack of a better description. And, you know, words are really detrimental and harmful. Mm. And, you know, there isn't even today much consideration for things that she says, or any acknowledgement for things that she has said or done in the past. And it makes you doubt your own reality. You know, we all talk about gaslighting.
Mm.
And I doubted a lot of my reality growing up. Mm. And it was an abusive way to grow up. And I choose not to live that way anymore. And I don't have malice towards her. I'm not angry at her. Mm. I'm sure she is hurt by the fact that myself and the kids choose not to have a relationship. But at the same time, I'm not doing it out of anger or wanting to hurt her. I'm doing it out of self-preservation.
You're doing it for the sake of your peace, which is what you've been seeking all along. And look,
correct,
the book is not about your mother. The book is about your story and your journey. but again, our parental figures play a big role, and she features quite a bit in the book. And the book is about your journey. It's about, I mean, you're entitled to fraud, and you, this is what you explained earlier, that it's just not just about the financial fraud and the financial act of the fraud that was committed, but how from as far back as you can remember, this is the one pattern that, you know, you kept feeling, if I can say, and therefore taking decisions based upon throughout your life. And so, yeah, the conversation has, you know, been around your mother a lot, but I just, you know, wanted to touch on that, that the book is not about your mother, but we cannot neglect and negate the impact that that relationship had on the trajectory of your life.
Absolutely. I mean, I tell my clients even that our adult life is actually about repairing the damage that our parents intentionally or unintentionally caused in our lives. And so it is impossible to ignore that relationship and the impact thereof. And now I get to be my own mother and my own father and my own best friend. And the book hopefully is teaching people how to open the door to do the same for themselves.
Just before we end the interview, so you've been seeking your tribe from the age of 14 when you started experimenting. Did you find a tribe in Sun City?
I actually did, strangely enough. You know, fraudsters tend to stick together. you will always find your people wherever you go, and as I said, everything is for a season. And for me, it was about also finding people that knew they had done wrong, because often in prison you'll find many who don't feel that they have done wrong.
Oh really?
Believe it or not, you're sitting in prison and people still don't feel like they have, they're able to acknowledge the error of their ways. Hence, people are repeat offenders. So for me, it was about finding people that were actually like repentant, I suppose. And really wanting to come out and make their lives different.
Nikki, thank you so much for your time. And thank you for the book, Fraud, How Prison Set Me Free.
Thank you so much for having me.
And thank you for listening to this episode of the podcast. Remember, you can like, rate, and share this podcast episode from the channel you're listening on.